This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have as my guest the one and only Greg Pallast, BBC correspondent. Pallast is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and most recently, Armed Madhouse. Greg Pallast, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Glad to be with you, Matt.
Tell me about the title of the book, because you mentioned Allen Ginsberg as your teacher, and you quote a line from him. Was he really your teacher?
You're already challenging the truth of what I'm writing about. Yeah, Allen Ginsberg was my teacher. I had two teachers, Allen Ginsberg and Charles Bukowski. Live with it. Ginsberg wrote, "The soul should never die ungodly in an armed madhouse." That's what we got. We got, you know, the berserkers taking over the asylum. And, it's interesting. With Ginsberg, I was trying to study poetry with him, and I couldn't decide whether to be a poet or an investigative reporter. And Ginsberg read my poetry and said, "You'd make a great investigative reporter."
When was this that you were studying with
this
him?
This is actually only just before he died, actually, only about 10 years ago.
Oh, I had a fun interview with him in his apartment in New York City for about 3 hours. I had to wait in line. There was BBC that was there. WGBH was there. They were all asking about the Beatles. I don't want to talk about the Beatles. I wanted to talk about his poetry. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah. We're now talking at the five-year anniversary of 9/11. And you write in your book, Armed Madhouse, about the fact that it actually was Osama bin Laden who did the deed. I've been writing a lot and studying a lot recently on these 9/11 conspiracy theories. You say in here, "So who did it?" And then you quote from a bin Laden videotape and you say, "Sorry, it really is bin Laden. The point is that there is more than one flavor of evil on this sad planet."
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a conspiracy, but we have to know what it is, okay? The conspiracy, for BBC television, I broke the story a month after the Trade Center went down, where, by the way, I worked. I had an office there. That the Bush regime had spiked the investigation of the bin Laden family before September 11th. And in fact, in our madhouse, we didn't have the document from the FBI marked secret and confidential. I love all that stuff that's marked secret and confidential. I don't know why they do that, because it's the first stuff I go to. As soon as it says top secret, bang. It says 199I, which means national security document. And it said, "Now you guys are released to go after the bin Laden family in America for their setting up what they called a suspected terrorist organization." And believe me, these guys had much to be suspect about, much. So you have to understand that there was a conspiracy. That is, when we use the term conspiracy, we mean, people getting together and deciding to do something against the public and not telling us, which, of course, is what they do. So there was a conspiracy, but it's not about, planning to take out a real estate in New York. It is about protecting their piggy bank known as Saudi Arabia. You don't investigate the Saudi money connection. So it was all about, so what I do have in there is spiking the investigations of the bin Ladens. And we also have in there, for example, spiking the investigations of the Islamic bomb, the Pakistan bomb, the AQ Khan connection in there. So we got this from CIA agents. We got this from disgruntled FBI agents. Well, let's put it this way. The FBI, we got the document. The FBI, we were working with the National Security News Service and we at BBC, and some FBI agents came in to question our coworkers. They left a folder on the desk and said, "Oh my God, we left a national security confidential file on your desk. We'll be back in a half hour to retrieve it," unless, of course, you need 45 minutes. Because there's all these agents who have said, by the way, I've never had one agent from the CIA or FBI say, "We could have gotten these guys if only we'd eliminated three amendments to the Constitution." They've always said the same thing. "We may have gotten these guys if the Bush regime got its foot off our neck and we could follow the Saudi money."
But the 9/11 conspiracy people would say, well, they didn't do that because, Bush and Osama were in on it, or Cheney and Osama were in on it.
They're, they're in on it together, but what are they in on? You have to understand, this is an international, as I explained in the book, it's an international gang war over oil, control of oil fields, okay? And control of, you know, Bin Laden's main target is not America, but the Iranians, what he calls the Shiite snakes, because they're sitting on, just like the Saudi royal family, another big pool of oil that should be under the Sunni caliphate, of course, and he's the designated one. So, you know, you have to understand that this is a fight over oil. And that's what I'm trying to bring out, one of the things I'm trying to bring out in the book, and that goes into the story of Iraq and everything else. But, you know, when you talk about the 9/11 conspiracy people, because after all, I'm talking about a conspiracy, just a different end of it. I'm not saying that you know, Bush is in on it. In fact, our rule at BBC Television, as I explain in Armed Madhouse, is that if anyone ever accuses George Bush of knowing anything at all in advance, is you've got to have a lot of proof. So, you know, it's like, you know, so accusing George Bush of knowledge is not one of the first things we think of at BBC. But, you know, these guys lie and people die. Okay, that's a journalistic factual conclusion, and therefore that could lead people to say, well, why not? Why didn't, you know, they could have done the whole thing, except that our evidence is talking about blinding the intelligence community, not using the intelligence community. So it was just the opposite. We were blinded, and blinded by the cash blinders, speak no Saudi evil.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Greg Palast, of course. He's the author of Armed Madhouse. Let's talk about Iraq a little bit, because you say that there were really two plans for the Iraqi oil. One was neocon total privatization, and the other was a more realist State Department kind of let's let the Iraqis hold their oil and we'll deal with them that way.
Well, you're bringing up one of the things we discovered in investigating for our madhouse, which these are the BBC reports you're not allowed to see on American TV. And I know that, Matt, that you have a lot of conspiracy nuts in your audience who think that George Bush had a secret plan for the oil fields of Iraq before we invaded, which isn't true. He had two plans, and we got them both. And it's amazing, by the way, you can't see this stuff on US TV. And
why
is
that?
I actually held up these two plans in front of the cameras for BBC. And you have to understand, this is the top of the nightly news worldwide, the biggest news program on the planet, okay? And you can't see this stuff of the secret plans for the oil fields of Iraq. So first, the most important thing in the book is that there were secret plans. Not even what they were, but that they existed, because you have to understand the State Department, Defense Department, and White House in writing told us at BBC, there are no secret plans. We have no plans. And then we find one that's 101 pages long. We find one that's 323 pages long, which turns out to have been written, the winning plan, the 300-page plan, was written by big oil executives. I know you're shocked. And how do we find that out? Once we got the secret document, which doesn't have any big oil company names on it, stamped State Department, right? What you have to do is say, we actually got a oil company executives to talk to us. They didn't realize who they were talking to. And when Harper's Magazine first ran a segment of our madhouse talking about the big oil writing these plans, they threatened to sue. An oil company executive threatened to sue Harper's. They said, we never even talked to Greg Palast. And so Harper said, we'll retract the story if you tell us what part of this audio tape isn't you.
You had him on tape.
Yeah, that's one thing we do that just isn't done in America anymore.
Why reporting. Can't you get this information on U.S. mainstream TV?
Well, you just heard the information. Now you know why it can't. It almost speaks for itself. Bush spikes the investigation of Bin Laden family. Secret plans for the oil fields of Iraq. And then, of course, the story in there about the called Kerry One, about the theft of 2004. I've tried to get this on U.S. TV. In fact, the BBC report, people know me in the U.S., if at all, from the story about how before the 2000 election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush knocked off tens of thousands of black folk before the election. They called them felons who couldn't vote, but they were, you know, just guilty of voting while black. We gave that to ABC News, which has the right to run it free. CBS News also asked for it, and they wouldn't touch it. They absolutely would not touch it. The Washington Post finally ran my byline article on it 7 months after the election was over. We ran this report on the theft of the election while Bush was still, while Al Gore was still in that race. We ran the story, and you couldn't get in the U.S. news for anything. 7 months later, the Washington Post ran the story, but by then Bush could read it from the White House, and it took 4 years for the New York Times to acknowledge the story. And, of course, it was never, ever run on American television, ever.
And but what's your theory? It's just too close to power?
Well, it's prefabricated news. I mean, Katie Couric couldn't I don't even know if I pronounced her name right. I hope I haven't.
Katie Couric.
Couric. Okay. Profile in Couric. You cannot get this stuff on U.S. News because it's not prefabricated. It's not from a press conference. It's not from a press release. What you see in our madhouse is organic news straight up from the documents and from the information. It's just not done anymore. It's too expensive. It's too risky. And let's face it, these media corporations are not going to allow news which upsets their political order. In fact, I have the story in there about the lynching of Dan Rather because we ran the story. I ran the story on BBC first before Dan Rather about the fix to get little George out of the war in Vietnam and into the Texas Air Guard. Rather reran. All he was doing was running our story from BBC. He was on my program, by the way, in Britain and said, I would like to run this stuff. So he did. And he said, but if I do it, I'll get lynched. And he was.
But
by the way, we've never retracted a comma of our story, not a comma. But any reporter that looks at the carcass of Dan Rather's career knows that they are toast if they touch any of these subjects.
But he did run that bogus document, and so that's what got him into trouble too, though, right?
Well, first of all, I don't know if it's a bogus document. In other words, that's the Roverian spin on the whole thing. It's a document we didn't use and was really completely darn sideways and crazy. Had nothing to do with the story of whether the fix was in for George Bush. And what they never ran, which we ran on BBC, was the payoffs, massive payoffs to keep this thing shut up.
Who was being paid off?
The guy who did the fix. I mean, one was Ben Barnes, okay? Even though CBS and Dan Rather ran the fact that Barnes admitted that he put in the fix, which we did, we ran that years ago, no one mentioned that he had some very nice paydays after that. And one other person who was very helpful to little George was a woman named Harriet Myers. And if people are scratching their head, how did Harriet Myers, of all people, get nominated to U.S. Supreme Court? The answer was she had George Bush's Vietnam medals and his cojones in her pocket.
I'm speaking with Greg Pallast, author of, most recently, Armed Madhouse. And we're talking about that book, among other things, today. Let's go back to Iraq for a second, and if you could explain, because I think a lot of people think about Iraq and U.S. companies in there and that it's a heyday for privatization, which it is to a large extent. But they didn't go all out in the oil sector and
There was one plan to sell off the oil fields. But ironically, and what we found out weirdly, it was the objection, it came from two sources. The Iraqis, and no one cared what they thought, but big oil. Big oil didn't want to buy the fields.
And why is that? Because that's counterintuitive.
Yeah, because they want to control the oil. Remember, they don't go in there to get oil, to bring it back so you can fill up your Hummer, Matt, cheap.
I don't have one.
That yellow one. That's not yours out there. Okay. They went in, as it turns out, not to get oil. This was not a case of blood for oil. I don't care what people say. By the way, that protesters should stop using that phrase, blood for oil, because Americans think that's a bargain, blood for oil. It's about blood for no oil. Exxon used its exploration company, the 82nd Airborne, to go in and find the oil and turn off the spigots. If you read the documents, it's all about keeping the supply of oil controlled. And in fact, in the documents, it says the purpose, our plan is to create a state oil company which will, quote, enhance Iraq's relationship with OPEC. What that means is that the U.S. government was creating a new oil structure for Iraq, which would make sure that they would stay under the control of the Saudi Arabian oil cartel. That's what it was about. It's about locking in Iraq as an oil colony of Saudi Arabia to the grand benefit, as we see, of Exxon and crew. You know, Bill Clinton left the White House with $24 a barrel of oil. It's now $74 a barrel. Mission accomplished. They didn't screw up. Read the plans. This was the plan.
And partly it's because if you can control the supply of oil, you can jack up the price. Is that
That's
right?
That's the point. You control the supply of oil, you limit it. The point of OPEC and a cartel is to squeeze down production, put a quota, a limit on every country's production. Iraq can produce 6 to 12 million barrels a day, and they're only allowed to export 3 million under the Saudi rules. And they wanted to keep it that way, because if Iraq were ever to unleash its oil on the market, that's the end of the $1 billion a week windfall that Exxon is getting right now.
And so for the oil companies who see Iraq down at about, what, $1 billion instead of $3 billion right now, they're able to make even more money.
Yeah. And in fact, I thought that it was wrong to give the $400 million bonus to Exxon's chairman. They should have given it to Zarqawi for having blown up the pipelines in Iraq. I mean, this is, you have to understand, this is how they make their money, not by finding oil, but by shutting in oil and making sure that there's less of it on the world market. You read these documents and it's chilling. You talk to the oil executives and it's chilling. But I advise you to talk to the oil executives wearing a wire.
And you also say that they didn't want, the oil companies didn't want privatization because they saw what happened in Russia and it just became kind of unreliable, unsteady.
Well, what happens with privatization, and already we saw the character we put in charge of Iraq for a while named Ahmed Chalabi, kind of a short-fingered vulgarian who was already cutting deals with oil companies, having secret meetings with certain of his crony oil companies. And what these guys do, as in Russia, is to cut deals with small companies and oilocrats, local guys, and the big majors get sliced out of the action. So in Russia, Exxon, British Petroleum, and the others put in billions, and they saw the money just swiped away from them with the Russian so-called capitalist regime in on the theft.
How do you see things playing out in Iraq?
Well, like I say, it's mission accomplished. I don't, you know, I'm sorry if people say, oh, it looks bad. It may look bad, but from these guys' point of view, it is about the oil. In fact, as I show in the book, we really found the clip in which the White House called it Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. It's about the oil, and it's about keeping control of the price of oil and keeping the supply limited. They've got that accomplished. And if they've got, and therefore the sugar daddies of backing the current regime, as long as their money is there, they will be able to get in close enough on the elections to steal the elections.
I'm speaking with Greg Palast, author of Armed Madhouse. Interestingly enough, Bush himself just recently has started to use that dirty three-letter word, oil, as far as Iran goes, because he says if the we can't leave the Iranians there with a nuclear weapon and control of so much oil, because then they can blackmail us. Do you see Bush going after Iran?
No, it's a great Punch and Judy show. Notice when the Mad Ahmed in Tehran makes his statements, I'm going to wipe out Israel, I'm going to build nukes. It's always when the price of oil starts getting towards that $65, $60 a barrel mark. And then Bush, you know, we're going to take these guys out. That happens when the price of oil starts drifting back down to 60. So they're basically blowing on the balloon together. It's a wonderful Punch and Judy show. There is no invasion of Iraq contemplated. You listen
of
to
Iran.
The guys on the,
yeah.
Excuse me, of Iran. And that's very important to understand. This is not – our target is not Iran. Our target is Venezuela right now. The biggest reserve of oil on this planet, as I point out in the book, is not in Saudi Arabia. I was able to get documents from inside the Department of Energy saying that the biggest reserve of oil, according to Bush's internal papers, is sitting under Venezuela. And Venezuela is under Hugo Chavez.
Well, so
that's why they got rid of him.
Well, he's still there, though. Do you see Bush knocking him off or trying again to knock him off?
Well, you know, Bush's spiritual advisor, the Reverend Pat Robertson, who's channeling our president's thoughts, has said, you know, Hugo Chavez thinks we're trying to assassinate him, and I think we ought to just go ahead and do it. And I think that that's their obvious move. I've met, as I mentioned in the book, I've met a few times with Chavez on this. And in fact, he offered to write an introduction to the Spanish language edition of my book. I said, okay, but you got a deadline. He says, what's that? I said, before you're dead. Yes, they have to eliminate this guy one way or the other, or contain him one way or the other, because the big problem for them is that Saudi Arabia, remember, does not charge us a fortune, a third of $1 trillion a year from these from the Middle East for oil right now, a third of $1 trillion a year. But it all flows right back to the U.S. as bond payments. They're buying up our ports. They purchase George Bush's treasury bills and fund George Bush's deficit. Hugo Chavez has actually told me he would like to see the price of oil drop by a third, cut a peace deal. He said it would help my country, your country's economy. Let's cut out this oil cold war. But he says, I'm not going to lend you back the money. I need that money to build Venezuela and Latin America, which is what he's doing. And that's why they got get rid of him. They're not worried that he's going to cut off the supply of oil. They're worried that he's going to cut off the supply of oil money. The petrodollars that are lent back to us from Saudi Arabia are not going to be lent back to us from Venezuela, which has to be our new source of supply. As the Saudi oil reduces, Venezuela's oil reserves increase and overtake them. We got to do something about controlling Venezuela.
There's a scary thought. I'm speaking with Greg Pallast. He's the author most recently of Armed Madhouse, a correspondent for BBC, which runs his reports that can't get on the U.S. mainstream media. Greg, you've done a lot, and we talked a little bit earlier on voting discrepancies and scandals in the United States. You talked briefly on how the 2000 election was stolen. A lot of people don't know that much about 2004, especially in New Mexico, which you write a lot about in this book.
Yeah, well, everyone's going Ohio, Ohio, Ohio. And it's true. I have some sections on Ohio about how the vote was shoplifted there, exactly how it was done. But the problem is we don't want people to think that it's all Catherine Harris of Florida, Ken Blackwell of Ohio, you know, like some couple ne'er-do-wells monkeying with our vote. The real issue is that we have a national scandal of uncounted votes in America. Kerry won, not just Ohio, if you counted the votes. He won New Mexico. He won Iowa. And I give you the exact numbers. What is not known to Americans, for some reason, is that 3.6 million ballots in 2004 were cast and never counted. Cast and never counted. Not in the Ukraine or Uganda, in the United States of America. And by the way, this is not one of my undercover investigative reports, of which I have many in there. This is from the Election Information Agency, the U.S. government, which you're not going to see reported again on U.S. newspapers. In fact, as I pointed out in the book, when I ran the story, Kerry won, which I did in The Observer, where I used to have George Orwell's old column, by the way, of England. And I ran that story in The Observer. The New York Times called me and said, well, Mr. Pallast, we want to do a story on the theft of the election of 2004, the what happened in 2004. This is a few days after the election. And they said, I said, great, I have tremendous files on this. You want to go over them? They're in New York. And they said, no, we have a couple questions. Question one, are you a sore loser? And question two, are you a conspiracy nut? That was it. There was no question three. And the New York Times ran the story the next day. Internet theories of Bush loss easily debunked. The internet theories being BBC and the Guardian papers of Britain. But okay. And they never mentioned us. The entire story in the Times was about some high school teacher whose statistics they were able to question. But they never took on the real issues of the non-count of the vote in the United States. Bad machines, spoiled votes. And by the way, if you're wondering, of those 3.6 million votes, about 88% of those were cast by minority voters. You know, and our time remaining, I can't give you the whole formula for how that's done. But baby, 3 million votes, almost 9 out of 10 from minority voters. You tell me who won that election.
Well, there's one statistic, Greg Palast, in this book that jumps right out. It says, if you're black, your chances of your vote being spoiled is 900 times higher than if you're white.
Well, 900%, right, nine times. So
how does that happen?
How does that happen? Votes don't spoil because you leave them out of the refrigerator. When we talk about a spoiled vote, a spoiled ballot, that means a ballot that can't be read. Hanging chads, punch cards that don't punch through, voting machines that just don't feel you know how to touch them anymore, and then 3 million people, almost all of them minorities, were given what was called provisional ballots in the last election because their votes, their right to vote, was challenged.
And what happened to those provisional ballots?
They got tossed out. See, what happened was the Republican Party ran a campaign of mass challenging voters by the hundreds of thousands. This hadn't been done for 50 years, since the days of Jim Crow. By the way, both parties do not do it. I'm not a partisan here myself, but I got to report to you, the Democratic Party does not do mass challenges. Hasn't done so in half a century. There's a good reason for it. It's against the law, okay? You can't target black folk and challenge them, okay? But they did it. But it went unreported, and even worse, uninvestigated by the government, because who are the voting cops? The U.S. Justice Department, first under Mr. Ashcroft, now Mr. Gonzalez. That's the cool thing about vote theft. It's the perfect crime, because if you win on it through vote theft, you now control the investigation. You're the judge. You're not only the perp, but you're the judge and jury.
I'm speaking with Greg Palast. He's the author of Armed Madhouse. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You say for 2008 that the vote is already being stolen, that Republicans are starting with a 1 million vote lead before a vote's been cast. How is that possible?
Because they know where the bad machines are. See, that's one of the gimmicks. They don't have to mess with the software. People are so worried about black box voting. And I agree. And I show reasons that you should be really concerned. But that ain't nothing compared to just the simple stuff of giving bad machines in Democratic precincts. And the worst is in native lands, in the Indian reservations, where you'll find in some precincts showing that 9 out of 10 Indian voters, native voters, didn't vote for president. I don't mean they didn't show up. I mean that they took their pickup, waited in line, walked in the voting booth and said, forget it, and walked out. 9 out of 10 in precinct after precinct after precinct. Because, and why? Because we don't give natives blankets with smallpox anymore. We give them bad voting machines that don't record their vote. That's how the game, that's the big way that the game is done, plus the system of mass challenges, and now the new gimmick, voter IDs. And the only people who get ID'd are named Rodriguez and Hernandez and Juarez. Do you see a pattern?
Well, Greg Palast, how do you rectify that system?
Throw the book at them.
But we don't have the books.
No. You have to look. Stop whining, man. You can't win with 51%. Progressives are going to have to win with 56%. You can do that. They can't steal all the votes all the time.
By an unstealable margin, then.
Yeah, it can be done. It can be done.
My guest today has been Greg Palast. He is the author most recently of the book Armed Madhouse. Greg, how can people get hold of the book?
Wherever decent, honest bookstores are, or go to gregpalast.com and see the videos you're not supposed to see. And you can also, find out where you can grab the book.
Greg, it's been great having you on the show.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.